Welcome to Witch Lit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witch Lit is brought to you by Thousand Volt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. All our titles can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. If you'd like to support Witch Lit, please consider buying us a coffee at ko-fi.com/witchlitpodcast. Dave Gaddy is a Southern male witch whose journey through the realms of magic and spirituality has captivated hearts. Hailing from North Carolina and currently living in Atlanta, Gaddy blends his ancestral roots with the ancient craft, infusing his practice with a unique Southern charm. With a deep connection to nature, he navigates the realms of folklore, spell work, and a passion for ancestral magic, sharing his insights in a way that resonates with the soul. In his new book, The Simple Magic of Wild Things, Gaddy weaves the tales of his experiences, revealing the wisdom of a Southern male witch, walking a path that follows dusty roads, mountain wisdom, and a heart full of humor and passion. Dave Gaddy, welcome to Witch Lit.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's good to talk to you. And as listeners will know, I always get kind of excited when we have a Southerner on the show. So,
well, I'm as Southern as they get.
Very good. So our first question for everyone on the show, and you know, in this age of short attention spans and social media and all of that, you know, why still write? Why still write books?
Well, it's always been a dream of mine to be a writer. And I realized that we could do blogs, we could do everything else in between, but there's something about holding that piece of you in your hand. And I'm a book nerd, so I love the smell of a book anyway. Mm-hmm. So just like I said, just having that part of your, and for me, it's a part of my soul in a solid form, in a form that's going to last through history for a little while. You never know what's going to happen with the internet. Blogs could be erased. Yeah. I mean, trust me, we just went through a huge thing with our company where that big thing just shut everything down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But this will be, I mean, I'm still reading books that were published in like 1903. Mm-hmm. So that's my goal, to see my book in the hands of somebody 100 years from now and it make a difference.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I was just, you said, you know, books from 1903. And I was like, yeah, like so much of my current research, I'm like looking at, you know, what would be dusty tomes, except they're on our Gutenberg Project or archive.net. Mm-hmm. They're published in like the 15 and 1600s. And you're like, yeah, that I'm, you know, meeting minds with somebody who lived 400 or 500 years ago is kind mm-hmm. of wild to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I love that. I love that. I don't know that anybody's talked about the longevity of books that way. I like it. So am I right that this is your first book?
This is my
first
book.
Published book. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you about kind of that journey and like finding your press and getting published and all that. And what has that been like for you, like on your writing journey?
Oh my gosh. First of all, it was a terrifying process because I've always wanted to be a writer. And I've done blogs in the past and things like that, but it was the goal of putting my voice out there, putting my experiences out there so that it might help somebody else. Mm-hmm. And the process was actually not horrible for me. I mean, my publisher is Rebel Satori Press, and Sven made it such an easy process, honestly. Mm-hmm. But the whole thing was getting what I wanted to put down into book form in my mind, make an outline. And I did this before I even approached the publisher. Mm-hmm. Just writing a synopsis of what I wanted to write, making the outline, trying to figure out the direction. I mean, chapter names, things like that. In my mind, I had a title already working, but it didn't fit what I needed it to do. It was mm-hmm. deep fried and dirt grown. So what happened was the title was reworked, and then deep fried and dirt grown was the first chapter. Mm-hmm. so that it's such people, I don't think people realize how much of an organizational project it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's trying to find out. I mean, luckily my dad is a pack rat. So he has old pictures, old letters, old family history. So that wasn't a challenge for me. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times when you have to research and pull and find things, that can be make it even longer.
Yeah.
But yeah. For me, like I said, this was a very easy project, to be honest. It, more than anything, it was just horrifying for me because I was laying myself out there for everybody who could get a copy of the book. And that's a vulnerability that I had to decide, was it worth it?
Yeah. I will say, unlike, I think, a lot of kind of magical books on the market, it's very memoir-esque, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, you tell a lot of family stories, you tell a lot of your own stories, and then with the, you know, kind of journaling prompts and rituals in between. And mm-hmm. for folks who haven't read it, kind of a synopsis. And, you know, in a nutshell, but, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, having grown up in the South and East Tennessee, so on the other side of the mountain for me, basically, mm-hmm. Like so much of it was so familiar, like mm-hmm. it made me nostalgic. And, after I finished it, I wound up dreaming about one of my aunts that I haven't had really any kind of contact with since she passed. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. But yeah, it just, it is very much, I can see why you originally tried to go with Deep Fried and Dirt Grown, because yes. It is so much of the experience of growing up in the Appalachian South.
Mm-hmm. And that's just it for me too. It was, I wanted something that could help the new witch mm-hmm. or the one who's been practicing a while, mm-hmm. just like the one on Rekindling the Flames.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. We all go through those lulls in our practice.
Yeah.
And for the most part, we tend to forget what made us fall in love with magic to begin with. Mm-hmm. It kind of becomes a dull memory. So that's my challenge in that chapter, is to help you to remember what first drew you to magic. What first made you excited about it? So it's things like that, things mm-hmm. like just, and in maybe a little too much information, my next book, one of the things that I talk about is being who you are and calling back your power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it's important for us to realize that the words that we use can take effect on us as much as anybody else.
Yeah.
So if you have negative self-talk, and you'll find in my books that I'm very mental health awareness mm-hmm. type focused. And a lot of it is we don't realize the power that our words have on ourselves. We're willing to say, oh, I'm a powerful witch. I can do this to whoever. But we don't stop to think, well, what am I doing to myself with my words?
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. It made me think of this thing I saw recently, and it was just like a, you know, I think kind of a throwaway meme post on the internet. And somebody said, you know, you read time travel stories, or people talk about, like, if you went mm-hmm. back in time and changed something, the massive ripples it would have in the current. And they never think about what are they doing today that changes that mm-hmm. future. Like, you have that exactly. same power in the now to do that.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh, yeah. But no, I really enjoyed that aspect of your book about just talking about, and that piece in particular about, like, rekindling the flame. I was like, because you're right. So many of us go through either a lull because we've had life happen, or, you know, you just kind of drift away mm-hmm. from it. But what I wanted to ask you is how you first came to the path. Since we were talking before, and I know you went to Bible college, and in the book you mentioned that you were a Christian minister. Yeah. So how did one make that leap, I guess?
Always, which in the book I talk about, as a child, I've always had those certain giftings. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's just a natural progression, especially with my grandma, who essentially did granny magic. And like I said, you'd never hear her call herself a witch, but you'd never hear her call herself technically a Christian either. Mm-hmm. But just kind of growing up in the midst of it. So I was always exposed to something like that. So it was just kind of a natural progression for mm-hmm. me. And even at a young age, I was trying to find information, and good luck back then. I mean, this was back in the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. Good luck just finding the information wasn't out there like it is now.
Yeah.
And just had to do some digging and talking to people and things like that. And even in the church, and this is going to sound so bad. Hopefully if church people are listening, just take it for what it is.
Yeah.
I learned a good part of witchcraft behind the pulpit. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think about it, in the church, I learned to meditate. I learned to manipulate energy because one of the churches I worked in was Pentecostal. Mm-hmm. I learned so many practices there. And I mean, I like to tell people I was witching behind the pulpit the whole time. And how I actually got involved in the ministry is a wild tale in itself, because I had actually gone to my pastor at the time to come out of the closet. And I go in and he sits there and he's like, I know what you're going to tell me. And I'm like, oh, you do? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, okay, go ahead. He's like, you're called to the ministry. And I went, okay. I mean, it was easier than coming out, but that started my process.
Yeah.
So I got my undergrad, got my ordination, all of that, mm-hmm. just on a whim. But I mean, like I said, the path to the craft was the easy part.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just kind of following your nose and just doing some digging. And that's one thing that I really push a lot is do the work. Mm-hmm. I mean, no matter what you're doing, do the work. And I think that a lot of times we get the TikTok version of witchcraft where they're like, well, if you want to be a witch, you just do this and this and this. Well, that's true to a degree, mm-hmm. but you still have to put the work into your practice.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. And I do think TikTok kind of flattens things a little bit too. Like mm-hmm. there are many kinds of witches and witchcraft and people who do magic who don't call themselves witches and would be exactly. offended by that word, you know. And I think I do not have a problem with aesthetic, with the witch aesthetic, because, you know, former goth girl, like mm-hmm. I get it. It's attractive. but I do think people have an idea that that's what witches look like. And I'm like, no, that's also not
yeah,
true.
Yeah, the guys are all buff and
yeah.
standing out.
Fabio
in the
stand-ins from, you yeah. know, 80s bodice ripper novels.
Yeah, I've got like, all that hair.
For listeners who don't know Dave, he has a very clean shaven head.
So, yes, completely bald.
but yeah, and it's funny you say granny magic, because I think about that too. Like just growing up with an Appalachian family, like they had things they would do that were just like, you know, folklore based, or it works. You know, they would have never called it magic. They've never called themselves mm-hmm. magicians or witches or anything like that. It was just stuff that worked, because if you lived in Appalachia, you had to make do. You were your own doctor, mm-hmm. lawyer, exactly. everything. So, yeah. But yeah, it just fascinates me how many.
Think about it. That's why so much herbalism's in the Appalachian mm-hmm. area. I mean, they had to make do with what they had. So they had to forage for anything that they thought might help headaches or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that, you know, that mingling of, like, you know, English and Scottish and German Europeans mm-hmm. who came to the mountains, and the indigenous people who lived there, and the enslaved people that were brought there too, like all of that mishmash of stuff. And mm-hmm. yeah, it's, you know, I don't know that you could ever sort it out at this point. I mean, I know there are scholars who are working on it, like, where did these things come from? But, you know, for families who grew up in there, I think it's all of a piece. And we just kind of do that. But I do think there is like a broader cultural idea that Appalachia is white. And I'm like, there are white people in Appalachia, but Appalachia is not just white people.
Right.
So for this book, for folks who haven't read it yet, so the chapters are kind of laid out. You tell a story. And I love that this is the approach. It's very, very Appalachian in that way. You tell a tale. And then you invite people to like figure that. How does that same idea reflect in their own life? And then there's a way to actually work that process. So how did you work through that in the book? Because I feel like it doesn't feel formulaic, but it could have. But each one is unique. And so how did you figure that out for yourself?
That actually came naturally. I mean, I was surprised because it's just like when I would sit down to write a chapter, the first thing I would do is kind of think about, okay, what's this chapter about? And that would be the entry quote. And I write the way I talk. So it comes across as, okay, let's tell you a story. Then let's figure out how you can apply that to your life. And then I'm going to give you what I do and show you a direction. And it could be, I also taught middle school and high school for a few years. So that could be part of it too.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to the point that you did your lesson plans, and I always kind of wanted to engage the students. So I would start with, this is kind of the synopsis. Then here's a story. This is what we need to accomplish. How can you do that? And then here's how I'm going to show you how I do it and where we can go from there.
Yeah. Let's say, Dave, you're a Renaissance man. you've done a little bit of everything. So
I've never wanted to be 80 years old and say, I wish I had.
Yeah. Well, I think you can probably say that now. Not that you're 80 years old, but no. One of the stories, I mean, the family stories really were so reminiscent of my own family in so many ways. But the story that really stuck with me after I finished your book was about the Green Wizard. And just that interaction with someone, again, for folks who haven't read the book, I'll get it if you want the whole story. But just that interaction with someone who probably most needed a friend in addition to like the life things that we all need to sustain ourselves. But yeah, it just resonated with me. And obviously with you as well in the telling and kind of the fallout from that story. But like, because so much of the book is personal, I wonder, like, when you said it was terrifying to put yourself out like that. So how did you turn off that editor that was like, I'm not ready to share this, or maybe I'm not ready to be this open. Like, how did you kind of navigate that?
Well, and what I would do is I just write. And that's one of the pieces of advice that my publisher gave me, just write. So I would write, and then I would go back and reread it. And if I'm like, okay, that hurts a little bit too much, or that's a little too personal, maybe I should take that out right now. And like I told you at the beginning, I'm an open book. I'll talk to you about anything, tell you anything. I don't have any secrets. And at this point in my life, I've overcome a lot, fought through a lot, and I'm a stronger person for it. So most of the book is, I haven't held back. There may be a paragraph that I eliminated because of what we were talking about, the vulnerability. But I figure if I've felt it, somebody else has. It's just like one of the things I talk about is one of the challenges for me is I was always taught to be so afraid of everything at first. And when I ended up working or going to help out at that that hospital in the book, mentally challenged people horrified me at the time. And I think a lot of it is because I recognized the mental illness in my family and that it kind of tweaked something in the back of my mind. But fighting through that fear and walking into it head first and being willing to try something that I was afraid of actually helped me to overcome that fear.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I thought, like, when you talk about that, about, you know, like the fears that are instilled in us as children, because our parents have used that as a coping mechanism, right? That is their own coping mechanism that then becomes a crutch or detrimental. Like it might have gotten them, they've survived whatever happened, but it doesn't serve them in the rest of their life, but it continues. Mm-hmm. And I thought about that a lot, about, you know, so much of Appalachia, and I think from people outside of Appalachia have a lot of stereotypes about Appalachian people in the area, mm-hmm. and are currently, when this comes out, we will already know the outcome of the election, but our currently running vice president has done a lot to,
tarnish that.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, I just have a lot of feelings about him, but, mm-hmm. and his view of Appalachian people. But, I mean, there is so much strength and survivor instinct and mentality and taking care of your own and closeness and family. And then there is also violence and mental illness and, you know, mm-hmm. all the things that come with that. And I appreciate that you didn't shy away from that in your book. But the thing that resonates is that isn't the takeaway.
Right.
That isn't the takeaway. And I think that to me was a truer explanation of what Appalachian families are like. I mean, you know, what is the quote, all happy families are alike and each unhappy family is unique in its unhappiness, or something like that. And so I think, you know, no two Appalachian families are probably the same, but the thing that comes through is these people learned how to survive.
Exactly. And I think that's huge with us as magical practitioners. Mm-hmm. We have that same survival mode.
Yeah.
We have that same strength. And I think a lot of times we kind of diminish the magic, especially when it comes to ourselves. If you think about it, when somebody on Facebook or something, some other platform asks for healing or energy, we're way willing to throw it out there. Mm-hmm. But to do it for ourselves is hard because you have to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And I think as people of the craft, we've had to hide for so long that it's hard to make ourselves vulnerable.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, there is this, like when you grow up in a small town and everybody knows your business,
mm-hmm.
it's like you are equally the outcast and belong at the same time because you're their weirdo. Is kind of how I always described it. I was like, yeah, I was a weirdo, but I was their weirdo.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be kind of detrimental to your self-worth, I think.
It can.
That you, especially for those of us who went away and came back at mm-hmm. some point, you are the person you were to them when you left, not the person mm-hmm. you've become. And it's easy to kind of entrench in that again, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But and I don't know that that's unique to Appalachia. I think that's just small town life anywhere.
Right.
But,
exactly.
But yeah, it's, you know, I think there's just a lot of challenges. And I think that the strength, I don't know, it was my Appalachian soapbox for the day. Sorry. You know, I think the strength and the make-do-ness sometimes gets pushed to the side.
Exactly.
For the more titillating stories or whatever. So.
Well, and that's one of the things that I did strive for in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of the stories aren't exciting. They're just stories that may help,
mm-hmm.
that tell you who I am, where I came from. And I think without those stories, the book would be kind of hollow.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, because it is so much your personal practice and how you develop that over time. And one of the things that at the end of the book that people will know when they pick it up is there are a lot of recipes for incense. And I was like, This is Dave. This is not really an Appalachian thing. This is not Appalachian magic. That's a Dave thing. But I think that, again, that's true. It's like also Appalachian magic is not like a museum piece. Like, these are living people, you know, and it's going to grow and change as it contacts other influences in the world. And so I just appreciated that too.
And I like to use this example is my grandma taught me how to cook. Even following her to the T, my recipe is going to turn out differently than hers. So the incenses and the oils that I put in there are years worth of putting things together that didn't smell right, that didn't work right.
Yeah.
And then finally, it's what I wanted. My favorite one is the one that I use bacon grease as the base oil. Just because when I anoint a candle with that, and I use that sometimes for my ancestral work, just because it reminds me of the South.
Yeah.
When I smell that bacon grease hit that flame, it's just, I'm back in North Carolina again.
Yeah.
Smelling my grandma cooking bacon and eggs over the stove.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. I saw that and I was like, oh yeah, that's Southern kitchen smell. That, I don't know if you grew up with the drippings thing on the stove.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Typically it was a great big old can that was used for something like from hominy or something like that.
Yeah. My mom actually had one that was from this like aluminum 50s canister, like kitchen set that had like a little filter on the top of it.
Oh, really?
It's very fancy. It's very fancy. But it still said drippings on the outside.
Of course.
So, yeah. And I was like, okay, that's funny. But, and now I just have one on my kitchen counter so I don't pour grease down my sink. So, like, we don't cook with it, but we just don't pour grease down the sink. Yeah. Yeah, it's so funny, the things that resonate, you know. But, and I think that's one of the things that I appreciate about what you said about learning to cook from your grandmother, is that, you know, you can write a book and you can tell someone how to do a spell or how to make incense or an anointing oil, but, you know, the variance in ingredients, experience, you know, temperament, all of those things, like, it's always just going to be a signpost to some extent. It's never going to be exactly replicable.
Exactly. And it's just like the amounts that I put in, you may not like the smell of those particular amounts and may need to adjust it for yours.
Right.
And that's one of the thing I tell the things I tell the people that get the book. Use it as a guideline. It's not a Bible, I promise you.
Yeah.
Just use it as a recipe book.
And even the Bible is not the Bible.
Exactly. Exactly.
As I get struck by lightning. Sorry, Granny.
Well, that's just like that the Bible story that I've got in there. About the, you know, how those Southern families all keep that humongous Bible on either on an end table or something like that. And oh my gosh, that thing was packed full of everything she could get in it. I mean, it had pictures, birth certificates. I mean,
yeah.
Oh my stars, I've never seen it. But, well, yes, I have. My mom's got one.
Yeah. I have a box. I don't have a family Bible. I have a box.
I don't either.
But I loved that from that story about, you know, be careful, don't let the blessings fall out when you pick it up. And that was a way to talk about how to handle people too. It's like,
it kind of, that actually struck me as I was writing the book, because when I was putting that story about the brick of the Bible in, I'm sitting there typing that last line where it says, don't let the blessings fall out. And I'm like, we need to think about people the same way.
Yeah.
You have to be kind of gentle with how you hold them or deal with them, because you never know what they're going through and the blessings that are left may be falling out.
Yeah. Yeah. No, no, there's a lot of wisdom in this book. And I think anyone who has a connection to the South, I think, would enjoy it because of that, because it's stories we've all heard in some way. They may look totally different. The people look different, you know, but that kernel of wisdom, I think, is there. So I just really appreciated that. So now that the book is out in the world, what has that been like as a new published author?
Have mercy. It has been a lot of work. And I think you know this. Mm-hmm. Between promoting myself, which is hard for me because I'm very introverted. I'm what they call an extroverted introvert. Mm-hmm. And to have to be on when I do signings and things like that and teaching classes and stuff like that is hard. But the thing is, it's so worth it to be able to kind of see those aha moments. I did a signing a couple of weekends ago at one of the local bookstores here, and a 16-year-old kid with his mom came to the signing table, and he picked up the book, read through a first little bit of it, and he's like, "Mama, please, can I get this?" And she's like, "Well, yeah." He's like, "Mama, there's a lot of us in here." And when he said that, it just kind of smacked me upside the head. And I'm like, that's what you tried to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's so nice when you get to see those moments.
Exactly. And that's just it. As much work as it is. I mean, think about it. The deadlines, the peopling and all that good stuff. As hard as that is, those moments are what make it worth it. Yeah. That's why I wrote the book to begin with. I didn't write it to become famous. I didn't write it to become rich. I did it to put my voice out there in hopes mm-hmm. that it would help somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I know there are people out there who write to become rich and famous, and I wish them well. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't happen much in our corner of the publishing industry.
Exactly.
I mean, there are still what does Thorne Mooney call them? Big name pagans. Those people mm-hmm. still exist. But for the most part, most of us are just in the trenches doing the slog. So mm-hmm.
exactly.
Yeah. Have there been things, or did you have things that you kind of imagined? Like, what have been the surprises, I guess, for you?
I think the reaction of the people, honestly, mm-hmm. To hear how much it does resonate in certain areas. Just because, I mean, I had my little circle of friends, and you know how they're going to be, "Oh yeah, that's such a good, mm-hmm. a good yeah. blog," or this, that, and the other. But to hear strangers say, "This really touched me, and I could really relate to it," or just to hear that little 16-year-old boy say, "Mama, this is like us," mm-hmm. and to ask his mom for a copy of the book.
Yeah,
I mean, that's what's just kind of, it's been like, whoa, this is actually doing something.
That's got to feel pretty good.
It does. It does. Because like I said, my background in the ministry was about helping people. Mm-hmm. That's always been a part of my makeup. I think as Southerners were raised with that. But to actually see it helping people is something totally different.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So as an extroverted introvert, which I am as well, which people always surprise when I tell my podcast. I was like, yeah, but I'm just talking to one person. It's different. Do you have like a way to reset after you have to be on like that?
I have to essentially shut down. And that means just getting in my recliner, blanket on my legs, put headphones on, and just zone out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And go to the woods. So
yeah, I have always been a little bit of a hermit, and then you know COVID made that a little too easy to be a hermit. Mm-hmm. And I have found since you know things have, I mean COVID's not over, but since things have been opened up, I went to a local convention for something not in the witchcraft magic world, and for fountain pens because I'm a fountain pen nerd. And there were so many people, and my husband and I both got there and we're like, I mean, we'd already paid, you know, we had to circle all of San Jose to find a place to park. And I was just like, I can't do this. It was too many people. And I was just like, mm-hmm. I think we stayed 45 minutes and left. And I was just like peopled for 2 days. Like, it just was overwhelming. And I'm like, Victoria, you're going to have to get past this if you're going to promo a book. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay. But because I know you went to Mystic South, right? Because mm-hmm. you taught classes at Mystic South.
And I went to Sacred Space earlier.
So it was that different than like assigning or something to be in that space? Like, I mean, I know that witchcraft magical conventions don't tend to be thousands and thousands of people. I mean, they're big, but they're not. They can be big, but they're not like.
But it's still a lot of people.
Yeah.
So my first time at Mystic South was last year, and mm-hmm. I am socially awkward. And it took a lot of just learning to introduce myself to people. Mm-hmm. This year was easier.
Yeah.
Just because I did know more people. I've gotten mm-hmm. to be friends with more of the people that were there.
Yeah.
But it's so funny. Last year when I taught at Mystic South, my publisher actually sat in on my class and he's like, I could see preacher kick in. He's like, it's not a bad thing. He's like, yeah. But I could see that happen. He's yeah. like, and I think that is what happens when I teach. You have to essentially adopt that persona
yeah.
while you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm socially awkward. So I'm not going to be the first one to introduce myself or anything yeah. like that. So,
yeah, I am a little shy in those situations too, and just feel slightly uncomfortable. And I think, you know, there's always that little bit of imposter syndrome too, that mm-hmm. kind of feeds that. But I taught culinary school for years and I have that same, the teacher persona takes over, or mm-hmm. I dissociate into the teacher persona, however you want to think about it. But yeah, it's a strange place to be because you want to make those connections.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have social anxiety, then you're also like, are they going to think I'm a total weirdo? And then you're going to think about the dumb thing you think you said for 4 days after you mm-hmm. talked to them. So.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Completely been there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a challenge. And I think the thing that is slightly comforting, and anyone, a long time listener to the show, so many of us are like this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, writers tend to be awkward people. Not everybody. It's not, you know, it's not 100%. But I think part of the reason that we're like is obviously we're in our head a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the job, right? But right. I think it's just sometimes it can be a challenge to be out in the world when you're used to being in your own head all the time.
Mm-hmm. And like you said, I mean, I'll stand there and just, and I know this is so weird, I just stand there and stare at somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I'm just trying to figure if I really know you.
Yeah. It's like, do I know you? Have I seen you on something? Mm-hmm. You know, like, yeah, where do I know you from?
Mm-hmm.
That, I always call it situational amnesia.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know you, but I don't know how or why or where or, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Ugh. So now that you're working on the next book,
mm-hmm.
does it feel different?
It does. Just because I've been kind of writing on it as I go,
mm-hmm.
it's not been kind of one of those where I'm just trying to do everything. And I mean, I've got my outline just like I did before,
mm-hmm.
Putting my chapters together and just letting it happen. Mm-hmm. And like you said, I start writing and then go back and reread and say, okay, that makes no sense. Let's take that out.
Yeah. Like, as far as like your classes you teach and the books, are they kind of on a spectrum together, or do you feel like your teaching is separate from what you're writing about?
Well, the teaching goes hand in hand with it because I talk a lot about ancestry and family in the book. Mm-hmm. My teachings are on ancestral magic.
Mm-hmm.
The first class that I teach is called Meeting Your Ancestors Where You Are. And it's essentially an introduction to ancestry magic. The other one is called Using Ancestral Magic to Navigate Trauma. And that's something I do talk about in the book is trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And how I've dealt with my own and some of the ways that I've used to cope and to dig. Like one of my favorite pieces are the 4 M's to deal with mental illness or mental health issues. Yes, use magic. Yes, use meditation. but to also use mediation and medication if you need it.
Yeah. I always appreciate the folks who come at the work from like modern science is not the enemy. Mm-hmm. It can do dumb things. Magic can do dumb things because mm-hmm. people do them both. Right. But, yeah, it's not an either or and shouldn't be. I mean, I don't think mm-hmm. that's healthy for any of us, but I always get a little weirded out when, shall we say, elements of the new age decide that science is somehow not real.
Exactly.
And I'm like, no, sorry. You're not going to cure your cancer sticking a crystal up your butt. I'm sorry.
And if you can, tell me what crystal that is.
Yeah. Like it just like, yeah. So I appreciated that aspect of the book too. It's like, yes, magic can be a really powerful tool, but some things are bigger than you and need, mm-hmm. they need outside assistance. Yeah.
Well, and on that same line, some things aren't that huge. Mm-hmm. Some things just take common sense to deal with them.
Yeah.
That's one thing that I remember, my background in the church. I can remember one woman saying, I got up this morning and I had to pray what color blouse I had to wear. And I'm like, honey, God don't care about what color blouse you're wearing.
You're not cursed because you got a flat tire. The same exactly. kind of thing. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I do think we, you know, it's one of the things that I think about is that, you know, part of being a person who does magic, a witch, magician, occultist, whatever term you use, mm-hmm. is you do have to embrace a certain degree of magical thinking. Mm-hmm. And there's a danger of stepping over that line into magical thinking that is mental illness. Mm-hmm. And it sometimes can be an interesting tightrope to walk. But I think, you know, I just always think it's good for witches and magical people to have a little bit of skepticism too. Like right. It helps us.
My grandma had a phrase that she used to use. It's called, you're too heavenly minded to be any earthly good. Mm-hmm. You can take that another way and say, yeah. Don't be so magically minded that you're no earthly good.
Yeah.
I mean.
I love that. Oh, I love that.
Well, and she believed that. She's like, mm-hmm. there are some people that all they want to do is sit and pray. And she's like, that's fine. But she's like, put feet to those prayers. Mm-hmm. She's like, if somebody's hungry, go buy them food. Don't sit and just pray that food is going to show up.
Yeah. What is that? You know, I always think about like, you know, even in medieval Europe, in the monastery system, like mm-hmm. these were people who had retired from the world. But they didn't really, because they fed local poor, they had gardens, they brewed beer, they copied books, they did all mm-hmm. of these things that very much kept them of the world, even in cloisters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even like anchorites, which is fascinating. If you want to go down a rabbit hole of anchorites in medieval Europe. People basically like had funerals and got walled up in the church and couldn't leave, but they still had like a window to the world. They could see the sermon. Mm-hmm. They had a personal assistant, which they would have called a servant or, you know, something. And, you know, people came to them for advice. So they were still of the world, even though that, you know, they had a funeral and were basically entombed in the church at living, mm-hmm. but they still served their community. Mm-hmm. So like, yeah. Like,
and I think that's huge. We've mm-hmm. got to be that part that serves the community. Mm-hmm. I mean, what good is the magic if we can't help other people?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we see so much in fiction that you're not supposed to do magic for yourselves. You know, that magic is to help other people or whatever, you know, you can't benefit from your magic, mm-hmm. which is kind of garbage. And then you also have the inverse right. of that, which is it's spicy self-care. And I'm like, no, yes, it can be, but it's more than that. Like you said, you have to serve mm-hmm. your community as well. We aren't islands into ourselves.
Exactly. And that's just like, I mean, as far as life goes, magic encompasses everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about it, your thoughts, what's going on around you, the spirit of the trees outside and things like that. I mean, it's not this little neat packaged box. Mm-hmm. And magic can get ugly, just like life.
Yeah.
I mean, we tend to like things in a pretty little package nowadays. And I think that, like we were talking about TikTok witchcraft. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of times we get it in a pretty little package there.
Yeah. And short form video with aesthetic meet the algorithm kind of stuff. And it's like, yeah, sometimes mm-hmm. it's just, you know, what I think that's one of the strong points of your book is that none of those workings require you to go drop $500 at the local occult shop. It's exactly. You know, Appalachian magic, I think, especially is about making do.
It is. And that's just it. Use what you've got on hand. If you don't have a red candle, use a white candle. I mean, mm-hmm. just if you don't have a candle, use something. I mean,
yeah,
it's just a matter of,
yeah,
make it work.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I think, you know, it's interesting. And I've talked a couple times on the show about, I feel like we're still, you know, though we have traditions and things that go back, and especially when you talk about like Hellenistic Reconstructionist and Kemetic Reconstructionist and all this stuff, like magic can go back a long way. But like this modern mm-hmm. witchcraft revival, we're still kind of in the infancy of that in many ways. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think about the long life of religious movements, you know, we're pretty new. Mm-hmm. And it's always interesting to me to see like the trends, I guess, in like public discussions around magic and witchcraft. And it, you know, now and with social media feeding that cycle, it seems like it goes a little faster than it used to, but.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
Oh, interesting stuff. Interesting stuff. So we have our game of chance question at the end here, but before we get to that, I wanted to give you an opportunity, you know, let people know where to find your stuff. And if you've got stuff coming up, like I said, this will air at the end of January, and just let people know where to find you.
Okay. Well, you can find me on Facebook under The Weathered Wise Man. I'm also on Instagram under weathered_wiseman_real. I'm planning on going to Sacred Space again next year, and also to Mystic South again. I've got some signings that are happening throughout that I'm still in the process of working out the details mm-hmm. on. And just pretty much just taking things as they come. And you can find my book on Amazon, The Simple Magic of Wild Things. You can also find it at rebelsatoripress.com. I think it's just rebelsatori.com. And you can find it at Barnes & Noble.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And I'll have links for all that for folks in the show notes. A little easier to find. So our last question, I joke, and I always tell Southerners on the show, you will get this especially because, you know, as a kid, you're told there are certain things you're not supposed to talk about in polite company. And those are my favorite things to talk about. Because, you know, I'm a devil Scorpio. So I want to roll this lovely purple die. And depending on what number I get, I'm going to question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. And if I roll a 6, you get to pick which one you want. Okay. And you can pass. So.
Okay.
Let's see what we get. 6. You get to pick.
Okay. What were the choices again?
So death, sex, religion, politics, or money?
I would say death or sex. Let's be interesting. Let's go sex.
Okay. So one of the things you talk about in your book is being a queer man in Appalachia growing mm-hmm. up and that. And my own family, you know, that has been also true of folks in my family. So how do you feel like you navigated that? Like, I'm trying to imagine like the difference between being what I imagine was a closeted gay man growing up in Appalachia and then being in New York. Like, how did you navigate that?
It was, I mean, like most Southern gay men, mm-hmm. when I was younger, you learn to push it down, mm-hmm. hide it as much as you can. I tried the dating girls things, all that.
Yeah.
No. So it was just easier for me to just go ahead and be who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually didn't find, even working in the church, I didn't find that much resistance.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always kind of found that it's easier just to be myself rather than try to pretend to be something else.
Yeah.
As a gay man, I've lived through AIDS. I had a partner who had AIDS back in the 80s. I've watched friends pass away way too many times just because they tried to keep secrets. It was easier to keep a secret and people think that you had some other kind of disease than HIV or AIDS.
Right.
But the thing is, there were just as many people in my life who were who they were, no apologies. And to see them, I mean, I can remember a cousin growing up that was as flamboyant as you could even imagine. There was no, you couldn't say, oh, he ain't gay.
Yeah.
but he never apologized for himself.
Yeah.
I mean, he was who he was and everybody just seemed to accept it.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of goes back to that, you're our weirdo thing, right? I mean, it kind of goes back to that, I think, a little bit. And there is.
I mean, Southerners like to put their crazy people out on the porch.
Yeah.
Let the neighbors see them.
I hadn't thought about that, but oh boy, you're right.
I'm not saying being gay means you're crazy, but I'm just saying.
No, but they do tend to put out, yeah.
Look what we've got.
Well, and there's also this tradition, like even in Southern literature and in family, of like you said, like a very flamboyant gay uncle, like it's almost a trope.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm. Exactly.
And people just kind of accept that that's part of, you know, and honestly, I don't think it was easier. Like I went to high school in the 80s and, you know, I don't think it was easier for gay people then. I had a lot of friends who came out after we graduated who had been closeted in high school mm-hmm. and, you know, I don't think it was necessarily easier and bullies can be horrific at any time. But I almost feel like there's so much more rhetoric and ostracization now in some ways, even though there's so much more freedom about it. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like the conversation around it is so much harsher because of politics than it when is. I was growing up, even though more people were probably closeted because it wasn't safe. But it feels harsher now. I mean, and I'm standing on the very edge of this, you know, I'm a bi woman in a cis looking relationship. So I don't catch the same flag.
Right.
So.
Well, and I think even within the LGBTQ plus community, there's still just enough ostracization. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just like, I have many friends who are trans and non-binary and mm-hmm. all of that. Back in the 80s, you didn't hear about all of that.
Right.
Not that it didn't exist. You just didn't
hear. Yeah, people just didn't talk about it or they weren't open about it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like because even some of the gay community or the LGBTQ plus community doesn't understand it still,
mm-hmm.
doesn't understand those pieces of the spectrum within the community that it's easier to judge what you don't understand.
Right.
And trust me, I have to practice the pronouns.
Mm-hmm.
I have to.
Yeah.
And that's out of respect for my friends who use different pronouns than I do.
Mm-hmm.
I have to be willing to refer to them as they.
Yeah.
And be okay with that not sounding right to me, but it being right.
Mm-hmm. The indoctrination of English lit classes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Even though the singular they is like from medieval English, even, which is funny.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, I don't know. I think it's, again, I think we're in interesting times and maybe I would like some boring times, but, you know, I just feel like a lot of this is coming to a head in a way that is like things I couldn't have imagined in high school, but also mm-hmm. not great.
Exactly.
Just a weird time to be here.
And it's like you said, with as much freedom as there is, it feels like those freedoms are slowly being hacked at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you don't really know what tomorrow's going to bring.
Yeah.
You just kind of have to be hopeful and move forward with what you got.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, I guess I'll get on my soapbox a little bit. But I think the thing, like, even inside the LGBTQ community, there are, like you said, people who are judgmental about trans people or non-binary people. And part of that, I mm-hmm. think, is also some of that survival mechanism, because they're the ones taking the flack right now, for the most part.
Right.
And I was like, you know, the thing to think about is that's the vanguard. They're coming for you. Don't pretend for a minute mm-hmm. that they're okay with you, because they're going after the trans people. You're next. And it hurts me so much when mm-hmm. I see people in the LGBTQ community put trans and non-binary people under the bus, because mm-hmm. the bus is coming for you next.
So, exactly. And that's just it. It makes me angry when we divide ourselves as a community, even mm-hmm. even in witchcraft, we right. can do that.
Yeah. Oh,
it
yeah.
It angers me so much to see a community divide itself on things that shouldn't be in a divisive issue.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm always amused by people
like,
who...
It's like you said, they're going to come for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I'm a gay cis male. That doesn't exclude me from who they're coming for.
Yeah. Well, and it's like people are like, I think, you know, with this, people are not calling it a satanic panic, but I think it is either an extension or a new version of it right now, you know, uh-huh. and people like the Satanic Temple and people that are taking flack. And I was like, look, I'm not a Luciferian witch. It's not who I am. But I will defend those people, because they don't know the difference between mm-hmm. me and a Luciferian witch. If they're coming for them, they don't know the difference. Right. And, you know, like I said, it's not my practice, not interested in that, but also, like, you know, yeah, we are all going to be on the same side of them throwing rocks. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's just like with me. I mean, I don't care if you're eclectic. I don't care if you're a hedge witch. I don't care if you're Wiccan. Mm-hmm. Solitary, what?
Yeah.
We are in this together. Let's act like a freaking community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Well, I mean, there's nothing like adversity to create solidarity. I just wish that we mm-hmm. could do it outside of adversity and make it a lot easier. So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, that was a lot of things that weren't related to sex, but that's funny. And I love that that's how that question always goes. It always starts somewhere and ends up something else. But, oh, Dave, thank you so much for coming on and for sharing your wisdom and just, you know, being yourself out in the world. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and I've enjoyed it so much.
Good. 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 And good luck with the next book.
Thank you.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shanekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram or Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. And thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.